defend itself. No nation should accept rockets being fired into its borders or terrorists tunneling into its territory. In fact, while I was having the conversation with Prime Minister Netanyahu, sirens went off in Tel Aviv. I also made clear that the United States and our friends and allies are deeply concerned about the risks of further escalation and the loss of more innocent life. And that's why we've indicated, although we support military efforts by the Israelis to make sure that rockets are not being fired into their territory, we also have said that our understanding is the current military ground operations are designed to deal with the tunnels, and we are hopeful that Israel will continue to approach this process in a way that minimizes civilian casualties, and that all of us are working hard to return to the ceasefire that was reached in November of 2012. Secretary Kerry is working to support Egypt's initiative to pursue that outcome. I told Prime Minister Netanyahu that John is prepared to travel to the region following additional consultations. Let me close by making one additional comment. On board Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, there were apparently nearly 100 researchers and advocates traveling to an international conference in Australia dedicated to combating AIDS, HIV. These were men and women who had dedicated their own lives to saving the lives of others, and they were taken from us in a senseless act of violence. In this world today, we shouldn't forget that in the midst of conflict and killing, there are people like these, people who are focused on what can be built rather than what can be destroyed, people who are focused on how they can help people that they've never met, people who define themselves not by what makes them different from other people, but by the humanity that we hold in common. It's important for us to lift them up and to affirm their lives. And it's time for us to heed their example. The United States of America is going to continue to stand for the basic principle that people have the right to live as they choose, that nations have the right to determine their own destiny, and that when terrible events like this occur, the international community stands on the side of justice and on the side of truth. So with that, let me take just a couple questions. I'll start with you, Julie.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just on a technical matter, does the U.S. believe that this passenger jet was targeted, or that those people who shot it down, they have been going after a military, thought they were going after a military aircraft? And more broadly, this incident does seem to escalate the crisis in Ukraine to a level we haven't seen before. Does that change your calculus in terms of what the U.S. and perhaps Europe should be doing in terms of a response?
Well, I think it's too early for us to be able to guess what the intentions of those who might have launched the surface-to-air missile might have had. The investigation is going to be ongoing, and I think what we'll see is additional information surfacing over the next 24 hours, 72 hours, the next week, the next month. What we know right now, what we have confidence in saying right now, is that a surface-to-air missile was fired, and that's what brought the jet down. We know, or we have confidence in saying, that that shot was taken within a territory that is controlled by the Russian separatists. But I think it's very important for us to make sure that we don't get out ahead of the facts. And at this point, in terms of identifying specifically what individual or group of individuals or personnel ordered the strike, how it came about, those are things that I think are still going to be subject to additional information that we're going to be gathering. And we're working with the entire international community to make sure that the focus is on getting to the bottom of this thing and being truthful. And my concern is obviously that there's been a lot of misinformation generated in eastern Ukraine generally. This should snap everybody's heads to attention and make sure that we don't have time for propaganda, we don't have time for games. We need to know exactly what happened, and everybody needs to make sure that we're holding accountable those who committed this outrage. With respect to the second question, as you're aware, before this terrible incident happened, we had already ratcheted up sanctions against Russia and I think the concern, not just of Russian officials, but of the markets about the impact that this could have on the Russian economy is there for all to see. I made clear to President Putin that our preferred path is to resolve this diplomatically. But that means that he and the Russian government have to make a strategic decision. Are they going to continue to support violent separatists whose intent is to undermine the government of Ukraine? Or are they prepared to work with the government of Ukraine to arrive at a ceasefire and a peace that takes into account the interests of all Ukrainians? There has been some improved language at times over the last month coming from the Kremlin and coming from President Putin, but what we have not seen is an actual transition and different actions that would give us confidence that that's the direction that they want to take. And you know, we will continue to make clear that as Russia engages in efforts that are supporting the separatists, that we have the capacity to increase the cost that we impose on them. And we will do so. Not because we're interested in hurting Russia for the sake of hurting Russia, but because we believe in standing up for the basic principle that a country's sovereignty and territorial integrity has to be respected, and it is not the United States or Russia or Germany or any other country that should be deciding what happens in that country.
At this point, do you see any U.S. military role that could be effective?
We don't see a U.S. military role beyond what we've already been doing in working with our NATO partners and some of the Baltic states, giving them reassurances that we are prepared to do whatever it, is required to meet our alliance obligations. Steve Holland.
Sir, thank you. How much blame for this do you put on President Putin? And did you use this incident now to push the Europeans for stronger action?
We don't know exactly what happened yet, and I don't want to, as I said before, get out ahead of the facts. But what I do know is that we have seen a ticking up of violence in eastern Ukraine, that despite the efforts of the Ukrainian government to abide by a ceasefire and to reach out and agree to negotiations, including with the separatists, that has been rebuffed by these separatists. We know that they are heavily armed and that they are trained, and we know that that's not an accident. That is happening because of Russian support. It is not possible for these separatists to function the way they're functioning, to have the equipment that they have. Set aside what's happened with respect to the Malaysian Airlines, a group of separatists can't shoot down military transport planes, or they claim shoot down fighter jets without sophisticated equipment and sophisticated training, and that is coming from Russia. So we don't yet know exactly what happened with respect to the Malaysian Airlines, although obviously we're beginning to draw some conclusions given the nature of the shot that was fired. There are only certain types of anti-aircraft missiles that can reach up 30,000 feet and shoot down a passenger jet. We have increasing confidence that it came from areas controlled by the separatists. But without having a definitive judgment on those issues yet, what we do know is that the violence that's taking place there is facilitated in part, in large part, because of Russian support. And they have the ability to move those separatists in a different direction. If Mr. Putin makes a decision that we are not going to allow heavy armaments and the flow of fighters into Ukraine across the Ukrainian-Russian border, then it will stop.
This is the Scott Horton Show. You're listening to Dear Leader.
Will still have the capacity to enter into negotiations and try to arrive at the sort of political accommodations that Mr. Putin himself says he wants to see. He has the most control over that situation. And so far, at least, he has not exercised it.
Tougher sanctions in Europe? Will you push for
Well, I think that this certainly will be a wake-up call for Europe and the world that there are consequences to an escalating conflict in eastern Ukraine, that it is not going to be localized, it is not going to be contained. What we've seen here is just in one country alone, our great allies, the Dutch, 150 or more of their citizens being killed. And that, I think, sadly brings home the degree to which the stakes are high for Europe, not simply for the Ukrainian people, and that we have to be firm in our resolve in making sure that we are supporting Ukraine and its efforts to bring about a just ceasefire and that we can move towards a political solution to this. I'm going to make this last question. Lisa Lehr, Bloomberg.
Do we know yet if there are other Americans on board beyond the person you mentioned? And how do you prevent stricter restrictions, economic sanctions from shocking the global economy, causing jobs?
We have been pretty methodical over the last 24 hours in working through the flight manifest and identifying which passengers might have had a U.S. passport. At this point, the individual that I mentioned is the sole person that we can definitively say was a U.S. or dual citizen. Because events are moving so quickly, I don't want to say with absolute certainty that there might not be additional Americans. But at this stage, having worked through the list, been in contact with the Malaysian government, which processed the passports as folks were boarding.
Are you listening to dear leader Emperor Obama pronouncing that? Well, we don't have any evidence. We don't actually know anything, but everybody knows that the rebels did it, and it's all Russia's fault.
Outrage about
in case you're just tuning in.
Regardless of nationality, it is a heartbreaking event. With respect to the effect of sanctions on the economy, we have consistently tried to tailor these sanctions in ways that would have an impact on Russia, on their economy, on their institutions or individuals that are aiding and abetting in the activities that are taking place in eastern Ukraine, while minimizing the impacts on not only the U.S. economy, but the global economy. It is a relevant consideration that we have to keep in mind. The world economy is integrated. Russia is a large economy. There's a lot of financial flows between Russia and the rest of the world. But we feel confident that at this point, the sanctions that we've put in place are imposing a cost on Russia, that their overall impact on the global economy is minimal. It is something that we have to obviously pay close attention to, but I think Treasury, in consultation with our European partners, have done a good job so far on that issue. All right? Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
All right,
yeah,
President.
Yeah, you're welcome, jerk. All right, so that was a stupid president. Should never respect presidents at all. None of them deserve it. None of them. What the hell? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Join up the chat room like me. That's what I'm doing right now. ScottHorton.org/chat. That's where the guys hang out during the show and talk to each other and to me. ScottHorton.org/chat. We're on the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM. LibertyRadioNetwork.com. I'm also on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. If you want to follow me there or, tweet me, I'll be keeping an eye on my Twitter feed if you want to do that. It's just the same old Ray McGovern and Gareth Porter on the show today. Ray's got what you need to hear, I think, about the likely shoot down of this plane in Ukraine. And Gareth has written something optimistic about the Iran nuclear talks. And that's a big deal to me. Because I want so badly to be optimistic about the Iran nuclear talks. You know why? Because for a little while I was, and it was really nice. And then Gareth wrote some stuff about how I should stop being optimistic about the Iran nuclear talks. So then I stopped being optimistic about the Iran nuclear talks. But now he's written a thing saying that I should be optimistic about the... Well, that's my interpretation of it. Positive signs that they actually are going to work out this damn deal. God, that's going to be great. Barbecue at my place that day. I'm so tired of the fake nuclear crisis with Iran. Ugh. Puke blood to death. Anyway, so the wonderful Gareth Porter is going to be on the show. Sorry for the beautiful imagery there. The great Gareth Porter, he's going to be talking about that. And also have an invite out to Peter Hart, who I hope gets back to me because he is a great media critic. I really like him. You know, he's one of these damn liberals or something, but man, he's really good on everything that I care about. You know, war and torture and all the lies that surround all those things. American foreign policy and its consequences in general. He's really good, and he's got a brain like a steel trap. Maybe he's got a really great spreadsheet. I don't know how he does it. But he keeps track of every damn thing that they ever said wrong. So every time they lie again, he goes back and cross-correlates it with all the other relevant lies that you might remember. And it's just great stuff. Fairness and accuracy in reporting. They're the kind of guys that you might read in the Bush years and think, yeah, but how are you going to be in Obama years? And then when the Obama years come, you're like, yeah, all right, man. These guys still hate the empire. Well, I don't know, hate. Peter Hart's a nice guy, but they still are hard asses on the American media's failures on imperial issues. Let me put it that way. And so I want to talk with Peter Hart about the media coverage. Let him talk with us about the media coverage of what's going on in Gaza. Because what's going on in Gaza, well, I'm going to talk about it. I have a couple of invites out, and I've actually I've already gotten two or three no's from my... Oh, I have one outstanding. I've been trying to invite Gaza guests on all damn day, and I can't get any. I've given up on Palestinians. Now I'm trying to get a liberal Jew on the show to talk about it. Our friend Max Blumenthal. That's my last invite I have out. But anyway, what was I saying? Something about the goddamn Gaza Strip? Oh, Peter Hart. I'm trying to get somebody on about Gaza, but the media coverage of Gaza is its own huge, separate, and important issue. And, you know, they take their frame. I don't know what trough all these kooks are drinking from and what it's laced with. But you got the President of the United States. You got every right-wing idiot in my Twitter feed. Jesus, where do they find these people? I know. It's half of America, the conservative movement. Thanks a lot, guys. You're really dumb. But them and dear leader Obama and everyone in the media... Oh, boo-hoo. They all say the exact same thing. Well, what would you do if rockets were just raining down on your town? Raining down on my town from where? From where? You get to just skip from where? From the prison where I've locked millions of children in maximum security for no reason whatsoever. And they're shooting bottle rockets over the walls, and I'm a hydrogen bomb nuclear power. How does that crap work on anyone? Seriously. You know how it works? I'll tell you how it works. Because you never get to hear otherwise. Well, I don't know how it is now. You know what? See, I'm 38. Just turned 38. And I thought I was 38 all year long. But that's just a different story. Point is, though, when I was a kid, say a teenager, you know, early 20s, first becoming interested in politics, paying attention to news and things like that and what's going on, I had Rather Jennings and Brokaw. I had the Austin American Statesman, which is nothing but a reprint of the New York Times. And then I had books. And then, you know, some talk radio. And I was slow to get on the dot-com bandwagon, I admit, because I saw it as a Federal Reserve bubble but I failed to separate the wheat from the chaff and really realize the true value in the internet really until the Iraq War came. Otherwise, to me, it was all just a big paper money scam. You could argue I read Jekyll Island too soon. But anyway, I had rather Jennings and Brokaw. That's how I grew up. You know, my dad was a Brokaw guy. Your dad might have been a Jennings guy or a Rather guy, but that was who we had to choose from. Yeah, add a little CNN, but it's all the same narrative from Washington, D.C. and New York, what they want us to think. That's all you had. Now it's the era of everybody's got the internet in their hand all day long. So it really could be that maybe younger people really do know better. Maybe they really do have access to people saying, no, no, no. Let me tell you something. The Palestinians don't have the Israelis penned in and are bombing them, okay? They're the ones who are penned, all right? It's maybe that at the end of the day, ultimately, at the bottom line, of all the cliches of the end of all arguments, maybe ultimately that is the difference between a liberal and a conservative. A conservative's knee jerks toward power. Whoever's already the most powerful must be the most just and righteous, say the conservatives. At the very end of the day, all the end of the arguments, at the very bottom line, ultimately speaking, a liberal, which libertarians are all the way to the left, if you read Murray Rothbard, far to the left of the communists who are right-wing conservative statists compared to us, to a real individualist, kind of a libertarian. I fucking spaced out. I forgot what I was going to say again. Oh, yeah. Liberals. Our knees jerk toward the underdog, toward the little guy, toward the helpless. And the Israelis are not helpless. The Israelis, watching footage of Israelis on TV running around like they're actually under threat every time the alarm sounds. Oh no, a rocket, a rocket. And everybody just kind of scurries around in all directions. It's embarrassing. The people of Gaza might get blown up to death today. Really. The people of Israel, no. If they're in such danger, how come they're sitting on the hilltop on their couches watching and laughing and eating popcorn? Huh? Oh, what would you do if Hamas was raining rockets down on you? You mean if I had kidnapped 2 million people and kept them in a Warsaw-type ghetto on the outskirts of town and kept them under blockade so that they're hungry but not starving. That's a direct quote. Put them on a diet so that they're helpless. And then they shot rockets at me. I guess I would go and try to stand where the rockets are getting shot. If that was how guilty I was, kill me now. But I've never kidnapped 2 million people and penned them in a maximum security prison for no reason whatsoever and held a bogus election that I rigged to make sure that only Hamas could win. So that I could say, oh, boo-hoo, your terrorists won the election, even though it's been more than a decade since Hamas did a suicide attack in Israel. I don't know if that's right. Something like that. There, it was Condoleezza Rice and Ehud Olmert held the election of 2005. Was it 6? I always screw that up. 2006. Hamas won. It was a coalition at first until they blew it and smuggled a bunch of weapons to Fatah in Gaza to try to get them to overthrow Hamas and kick them out of the coalition and cancel the election results outright. And then Hamas got the weapons and kicked Fatah's ass and kicked them right out back to the West Bank. That was Condoleezza Rice and Elliot Abrams and Ehud Olmert and Hosni Mubarak's conspiracy. The Gaza bombshell is the article by David Rose in Vanity Fair all about it. Ali Gharib was tweeting it out this morning, in fact. And they made sure that, you know, the Israelis collect all the tax revenue at the borders for the Palestinians, which means the Palestinian Authority doesn't have any money unless the Israelis give them their tax revenue. Well, what do? In 2005, they withheld all the money from Fatah so they could not provide the basic services that amount to their vote buying on the West Bank. And so anybody who would have gone out to prefer Fatah to Hamas had no reason to at all by the time of the election. And that was either deliberate or really stupid. But the point is, the election was held. The whole theory was before, oh, well, you know, not that they're terrorists. They kind of dropped that about Fatah and the PLA, but they just said, but they're unelected. They're unelected. And if they're not elected, then they're not legitimate. And why would Israel have to deal with an entity that is unelected? We're talking about the prison guards, basically, that Israel has hired to oppress the people in the occupied West Bank. They're unelected prison guards. You have to hold a free and fair democratic election. It's the birth pangs of the new Middle East, don't you know? We have to have a democratic election. And then they made sure that Hamas won. And then they go, oh, boo-hoo, Hamas won. And so all we got to do is just keep them under permanent siege, permanent blockade. Keep them hungry, but not starving. I want to hear that one at the water cooler in the offices across America today. Did you hear that the Israeli policy, officially, according to their highest level government ministers, is to keep the children of Gaza, half of the population of Gaza, are under the age of 18, according to the CIA World Factbook, which seems to be what everybody cites. Half of them are under 18. Keeping them deliberately in this open-air concentration camp, keeping them hungry, but not starving. Gee, everybody, did you know that? Did you know that the reason they're always talking about maybe someday coming up with a two-state solution is because there isn't already a second state? The Palestinians aren't the country next door. The Palestinians are the conquered population, living under martial law, living in totalitarianism, who have no representation in the government that rules them whatsoever. But oh no, what would you do if the people that you were murdering dared to fight back against you? Well, then you'd have to kill them. Is that really the best Barack Obama can do? Is that really the best that these conservative idiots in my Twitter feed can possibly do? Well, what if, never mind any facts or truth at all, but just, what if someone attacked you? Wouldn't you have to defend yourself? Gee, I guess I would. I guess you're saying that Hamas has the right to bomb civilians and murder children in Tel Aviv. Is that what you're saying? Because that's what Israel's doing in Gaza. Is that what you call defending yourselves? Here's how anyone can get their ass whooped in a moment on the Israel-Palestine issue. Just turn the thing around. What if, you know, people say, oh, Hamas doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist. Well, yes, they do. They're on the record absolutely recognizing Israel's right to exist. It's in the Likud party, Benjamin Netanyahu's party platform, that Palestine has no right to exist, that greater Israel includes all of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, as well as the Gaza Strip. But anyway, take your entire narrative and just turn it around. The Palestinians, ever since 48, have ruled this entire area. And they've gone from 50-50 to 60-40 to 70-30 to 80-20 to 90-10. And they rule it all, and they have all the Jews penned in an open-air concentration camp prison in the Gaza Strip, with Egypt keeping them blockaded in from the south. And on the West Bank, they're patrolled constantly by the Palestinian secret police and military who abduct and torture and murder their children. What is this? If that was what was happening to the Jews at the hands of the Arabs, end of argument. End of argument. You might even call it Jewish wisdom that there's a universal truth, you know? All human lives are equal. And it's just as wrong to murder a Palestinian as a Jew, as an Israeli, Palestinian Arab, as an Israeli Jew. Is that so hard to understand? Can you imagine the war that America would be waging against the Arabs if they were doing to the Israelis what the Israelis are doing to them right now? Oh, and all under the excuse that the tables could turn in an instant when that's such a damned lie? When Israel is the regional hegemon without American help, and we give them $3 billion a year, and all the F-16s that can bomb with.
Where no one else will go today.
What the hell happened there, man? Why was that turned down all the way? Oh, I know what happened. It was me. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Boy, the Hasbara is getting really sophisticated nowadays. First, you just tweet out a fake picture or a picture from another time and place, and then you have your best friend bust you. Right, because there are no actual pictures of dead kids in Gaza, right? It's all fake. You know, except for all the real ones, the scores of dead children there. Anyway, Ray's coming up on the show. I got to say about the Ukraine thing that, you know, my gut tells me that, yeah, it looks like it was probably the rebels shot it down accidentally. It could be, I guess, that the Russians shot it down accidentally. If the Russians shot it down accidentally, that could be really problematic. I doubt that. I don't think anybody's claiming that yet either. They might get around to it. In fact, I'm no expert on what everybody's claiming about it, I should say. But, you know, just because the plane fell out of the sky, I don't know how it's supposedly even really confirmed that it was shot down, or how it's confirmed that it was shot down by a surface-to-air missile as opposed to an air-to-air missile. Chat room guys, am I missing something? Or are all of these questions still unanswered? Now, Raimondo, and you could tweet me too, at Scott Horton Show. Raimondo had found this thing where, I got it here somewhere. Well, a couple of things here. First of all, there's this Spanish air controller who, you know, supposedly, this story is, and I haven't verified this, supposedly there's a Spanish air traffic controller at an airport in Kiev who was tweeting that some fighter planes went out there and shot this plane down and that they were working for Kiev. And this web address is kind of too difficult. In fact, just Google Spanish air controller, Kiev airport. You'll find it. Spanish air controller. And they have it all translated here. And he's saying that it was an air-to-air attack. Now, it seems to me like the footage of the fireball doesn't seem to indicate a smoke trail leading to the fireball. So perhaps it was, I guess there's no other reason for it to fall out of the sky that they wouldn't have had time to radio for Mayday or something, you know, I don't know. But it doesn't seem like there was a trail of smoke leading all the way to where they crashed in the video. But I don't know how big the debris field is necessarily or, you know, what the real truth is. But it just seems to me like what's the most likely explanation. It was Russian media that said that the rebels had taken hold of some anti-aircraft missiles a couple of weeks ago. And then, you know, you got amateurs who sort of figured out how to work it and pick their target poorly. That's the most plausible thing to me. And I'm not going by, you know, evidence, and I'm not making claims of truth. I'm just telling you, my suspicion is that that is the most likely explanation. Then again, it's not much less likely, I don't know, to me, that maybe the Kiev government saw that the rebels had got their hands on some anti-aircraft, so they went and shot a plane down to make it look like the rebels did it? Could be. They'd have to be pretty damn blind to how easy to find out that would be, you know, at least in the, you know, medium term. They'd have to be really sure of themselves to try a stunt like that. But then again, people try stunts like that sometimes. Could happen. But, you know, to listen to the president this morning is like listening to CNN last night, where they're saying, okay, look, we don't really know that the plane was shot down. And we don't know who shot it down. But since the rebels shot it down and the Russians helped them do it, you know, what should be done about that? What does this all mean? What should be done next? What's the next step? Blah, blah. This is the basis of all the questions on CNN. And Obama just said the same stuff. This is, oh, well, you know, the Russians have been training them and all of these things. And, you know, dear, kind listeners, just note, whenever our foreign policy people talk anything, say anything, talk along these lines, say anything along these lines about really anything going on anywhere, notice how they never tell you what happened before. Everything is ancient history. It's not last year's history even. It's just, forget it, it's ancient. Last month's history is just ancient history. Now, Obama can say, hey, listen, if the Russians are helping the rebels resist their government and they commit an act of violence, well, then that's on the Russians. Okay, in an absolute vacuum, as a thought experiment, if you're talking about, you know, make-believe nations with no other information, then I guess that's plausible enough. But instead, what you have here is an American-backed and European-backed coup d'etat overthrow of the democratically elected leader with the help of a bunch of Nazis who've now been incorporated as the new National Guard of the country. They don't have much of a military, so they've formed a SA instead, for the most part, seems like. And the people of the East, why, they don't feel represented by the foreign-backed coup d'etat government that overthrew the one that they had elected in a free and fair election as determined by Jimmy Carter and all the monitors, etc., back in 2010. And in fact, the president that everybody hated so much, everybody in the West hated so much and wanted rid of, had agreed to a deal. That was why his police weren't in the town, weren't there in Kiev to protect the government buildings any longer, was because he agreed to a deal that said we'll have new elections in December. Basically, he was stepping down before his term was up. He'd resign by the end of the year. They'd have new elections, which he was sure to lose at that point. And he would withdraw his police. He would pull back the police that had been fighting with the Nazis in the streets. And it wasn't just the Nazis. There were more than Nazis. But there were Nazis there. Real, bona fide, Adolf Hitler-loving Nazis. The right sector and the Svoboda parties. Skinhead thugs. Lovers of Hitler. And they seized all the buildings and ran the government out of town. And so these people in the East here are the ones who are resisting that. And, of course, Donetsk is where that's kind of the heartland of all of their industrial capacity and, you know, the wealth, much of the wealth of the nation. And so, of course, the Kiev coup government desperately wants control of it. But this is no different in kind than when America helped split Kosovo off from Serbia, which, again, was sticking it to the Russians. In this case, it's the Russians saying, hey. And in fact, they're not even, you know, the East has voted to declare independence and to join Russia, but Russia hadn't invited them in. Russia's not annexed these rebellious provinces at all. Everybody keeps saying, yeah, they're going to invade. They're going to invade. They've been saying that for half a year. Russia's going to invade. Well, Vladimir Putin clearly sees that as the trap the Americans have laid for him and refuses to take it. He doesn't have much to gain except a lot of debt. except an economic basket case if he does invade, even if he just takes the eastern parts, and even including Odessa and the port there, and the industrial heartland, still they're $1 zillion in debt. So it wouldn't make, and of course it'd cause all the other problems with the rest of the countries, the rest of the powers of the earth and whatever. They have no desire to do it, obviously. So that's what Obama left out, is that it was America that picked this fight 100 ways. Oh yeah, and then the Russians may have trained these people who may have shot something down.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys. So listen, I ain't met all the guys in East Ukraine, and they might be a bunch of bad dudes. They look like some pretty bad dudes with their rifles and their resistance. Not really on the side of anybody initiating force, but they seem like basically they're doing the same thing. In fact, that's kind of been, assuming Putin is pulling strings behind a lot of what's going on in the East, he's playing the exact American game. That's his joke, right? Is he's just doing the mirror image of what the Americans did. Nah, just occupy all the buildings and refuse to allow the government to govern. Take over the damn thing physically. And then, they don't have Nazis on their side. Although, you know, I really should do a lot more studying about Eastern Europe. But I got an email from a friend, a longtime listener of the show. Jeez, I'm sorry, I don't even want to get this wrong, but I think maybe he was in Norway. And he was saying, you know, now the Nazis in Kiev, yeah, they're Nazis. Svoboda, Right Sector, those guys are some no-fooling Hitler-loving Nazis. But all around, there are right-wing reactionary forces in power, and that includes in Russia, and that includes in East Ukraine, and that includes all over the place. It's the rise of the new right. And this is where I blame Greenspan, because I think that it's the boom and the bust. It's the bust that makes people revert to primitive nationalism, us versus them, instead of us cooperating with them in order to prosper kind of attitudes take precedence. And I'm not saying material wealth papers over every damn issue in the world. It doesn't. Not every issue is a material wealth issue. There are plenty of old grievances and God knows what. But, you know, I never did get Brendan O'Neill on, man. He wrote this really smart take on all this stuff, the recent European Parliament elections, where right-wingers and conservatives and radical rightists of various stripes won. And not all of them were a bunch of neo-Nazis, but all of them were part of this, you know, tilt toward right-wing reactionary nationalism. And you know, you don't need the EU to have a community of people across Eurasia. You know, that's the big mistake of the status, is that the larger the community, the larger the state must be. But of course, that's not true. Look at the internet. We already have a world community right now. You don't need a world government for that. So, it's not that I'm saying, oh, it's too bad a bunch of pro-EU parliamentarians didn't win or something like that, but I'm just saying, across the world, you know, what happens is it leads to violence, you know? The more terrible ideologies of the past come to the fore. If you think about Francis Fukuyama and the end of history and all of that, he was saying that, you know, communism and fascism are dead, but not nationalism, you know? And so it's prosperity that papers over nationalism and tribalism and that kind of stuff. But, you know, more or less, you know how they call it, quasi-free markets, mixed economies, and more or less sort of kind of participatory democracy is, you know, more likely than not to reign, at least for a long time. Or I'm not certain how sure he is about that. But you can see, like, well, what can lead to the rise of fascists? When people are really down and out and desperate and as pissed off as they are desperate. Otherwise, who's going to listen to a real no-fooling fascist? I mean, we can call Obama and George W. Bush fascists all the time, but they do step down after. Well, Obama hadn't stepped down yet, but I think we're pretty sure we can count on him trading seats with Hillary or whatever. It's a participatory fascism. Isn't that what Robert Higgs says? It's a participatory fascism, but... And it is becoming more and more fascist here, too. When you look at the militarization of the police and all that, you think, well, okay, so they got... I just saw someone tweeted me this morning, a local news story of a county in Tennessee where the Pentagon gave them twice as many weapons as they even asked for, and including a lot of fully automatic rifles and way more than they could possibly need and all of that. And yet... Even for me, I'm thinking, well, you know, this sheriff seems like a good old boy, and he doesn't seem like he's planning to massacre everyone in his little county in rural Tennessee, and he's not wearing a black uniform of the new Nazi National Police Force, and so, like, it's, even now, it's still just a room full of guns. It's not a massacre, it's a room full of guns. But none of us could even think of, well, what would it take for them to actually, like, deploy all of that crap and somehow use it against us all? What would have to be going on? It would have to be some kind of crazy civil war. What could possibly cause such strife inside the United States of America, where we, even during the Depression, and I know lynchings and a lot of mob violence here and there, but whatever. I mean, we have had peace between the states for 150 years now, guys, and 60. We've had more or less tranquility here. What would it take for our governments to need anything like the weaponry that they've assembled? Economic crisis, right? That's what it would take. It would take a nuke going off in New York and a massive crop failure all across the Midwest and a new complete global disinterest in Hollywood movies and, I don't know, whatever crap. Texas oil, some kind of absolute catastrophe. And even then, you look what happens. Every time there's a hurricane or any kind of crisis, people come together. They don't all go to war with each other. You're way more likely to need your weapons for home defense against the average robber on the average day compared to, you know, people coming to get the last of your granola bars that you save for your kids or whatever when the apocalypse comes or whatever. You know what I mean? If there's a massive hurricane levels your town, everybody goes out in the street talking about who needs blankets. I got blankets. Who's got water? We need water over here. And everybody helps. I mean, that's just how we are. It's only the government's fantasy we all tear each other apart without them. That's what they want us to believe. It's not true. So what kind of civil war would have to break out for the government to use what they have amassed against us? You know? The only thing I could think of would be, even in their imagination, a complete collapse of the dollar, a break of the dollar, the end of the division of labor and markets in America, an immediate reversion to barter and stand-in currencies until people can figure out, you know, till the market can decide a new currency, which, of course, the government would be doing everything to try to prevent from taking place anyway at that time. I guess if you had another real Great Depression, never mind the numbers and a lot of, you know, unemployment and unemployment benefits, but I mean a real-ass Great Depression where people are starving to death everywhere kind of thing, I guess you could see some martial law. But short of that... You know what I mean? The L.A. riots, that lasted 3 days or something. You know what I mean? But put yourself in the mindset of these sheriffs. And they're just people too, man. And their head is full of more meat than the average bear too. And so their attitude quickly becomes, like John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute was saying on the show the other day, if I have all this weaponry, I must need it for something. The people of my county, you know, now that I think about it, they have been getting pretty wild lately. And, you know, they have to. It's called cognitive dissonance. And people are just as likely as not to go with the BS to make their other BS sound right than fix their original BS. This cop, let's get real honest. The sheriff of this town could say the following sentence. You know, really all my department needs is about two or three deer rifles, two or three shotguns, and of course our 9mm that we carry. That's all they need. It's a tiny little county in rural Tennessee. There's nothing going on out there. Except, you know, children frolicking in the tall grass and wildflowers, man. It's the Mayberry from the fantasy. Yeah, I'm talking about this clip. It's on my Twitter feed. Someone tweeted it to me this morning. They interview Radley Balco, actually, in the clip, too. That cop, his entire sheriff's department could get by with the 9mm on their hip. Maybe a couple of deer rifles for a real-ass emergency. They don't need a tank. They don't need an entire room full of M16s. He says, well, you know, as the department grows, but then you can even see his brow furrow like, we're out in the middle of nowhere. There's not even a town that's the county seat of this damn county. Your county's not growing. You can possibly grow into these weapons. Ever. M16s and tanks. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Okay, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Raymond Govern's on the line, former CIA analyst, Soviet expert. So he still counts as a Russia expert, I think. He's a veteran intelligence professional for Sanity. That means he's the co-founder of that group, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and he writes all the time for Consortium News and for antiwar.com, and he goes around giving speeches to people about why they ought to be peaceniks and other subjects along those lines. And now he's got a brand new one that will be out very soon here for Consortium News, and then we'll have it on antiwar.com either over the weekend or on Monday for you. It's, I guess, the working title, no title yet, but KL007 we'll call it. Welcome back to the show, Ray. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. Doing well.
Very happy to have you back on the show here. Appreciate you making time for us. So before we get into the article here, can we just go over what's known and what's important but yet unknown about the crash of the Malaysian flight, the 777, that went down on the eastern border of Ukraine yesterday?
Sure. Okay, the plane was downed by a missile. Nobody is disputing that. The source of the missile, of course, is still in dispute. The U.S., particularly Samantha Powers at the U.N., is saying that they have a preliminary judgment that it was the anti-coup separatists, so-called, out there in the eastern Ukraine, often called pro-Russian, but their main beef is the coup that happened on February 22nd. Anyhow, she is pointing the finger at them. Obama is being statesmanlike so far on this. He has just made a speech which said two things of note. One is he calls for immediate ceasefire. That's big. That's what the leaders of Russia, Germany, and France were on the phone with Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, for 2 hours on Sunday evening, Sunday, the 30th of June. They pleaded with him. They begged him. They gave him all kinds of inducements and incitements. He thumbed his nose at them, checked with Washington, and launched this major offensive out into the east Ukraine the very next day. So why do I mention that? Well, because the fly in the ointment has been an immediate ceasefire. The Germans feel so strongly about this that their foreign minister invited his Russian and French colleagues, also foreign ministers, but not the United States or Britain, to an immediate meeting in Berlin 2 weeks ago. They again called for immediate ceasefire. The U.S., of course, says the same thing it says about Israeli aggression. Everybody's entitled to defend their own country, the Israelis and the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians are really a puppet in this play. And for Obama to join, in effect, the Russians, French, and Germans in calling for an immediate ceasefire in the wake of this incident is big. He's also called for an international investigation, and he has the support of Russia. He has the support of Germany and France, and even some of the rebels. It's hard to know who speaks for whom, but some of the rebels have said, yes, that's okay with us, and we'll guarantee safe passage for inspectors or for people who want to look at the wreckage. So that's the way the situation stands now. It's not at all clear who did it or why they did it. And as my piece says, it's going to be weeks, in my view, based on past precedent, weeks before we know for sure who did it. But the real problem, of course, Scott, is that over weeks, you can have an awful lot of fiddling around with evidence, especially the electronic kind of evidence that is so often used in these cases. And you can also stir up a lot of anti-Russian sentiment, which Fox News started doing yesterday. I fully expected more of an offensive today, but apparently Fox got the news, got the guidance from the White House this morning to stand down, await further guidance. And as I say, the president was almost statesmanlike when he made his speech just an hour ago, saying, look, let's have an international investigation and let's have an immediate ceasefire. So that puts Poroshenko in a difficult
position. All right. Now, it's a good place to break in here because your phone's getting a little screwy on us here, Ray. I hope you can still hear me all right, right?
Hear me.
Okay, great. Well, you sound terrible, so I hope we'll maybe you'll move into the next cell tower zone here in a moment. But as long as you can hear me, let me go ahead and set you up for comment by saying I read it completely the other way. I thought that he said we're calling for ceasefire just as much as we always have been, which was a disingenuous kind of way of saying that we don't want a ceasefire, just like he talked about when on June the 30th, he told them, nah, keep fighting. Don't cease fire, yeah. Even though that's what the Europeans are fighting for. And then, I guess on the investigation thing, I wouldn't disagree with that, except the whole context was, we don't know, but everybody knows it was the rebels, and because the Russians helped train them to be able to do it, and it's all their fault. So how did you and I see dear leader's statement so differently?
Well, because I didn't see it.
Okay. I was watching on TV. Scott. You were listening on the radio like Kennedy Nixon.
No, I wasn't even listening. All I've had is some little bit of press reporting here on my cell phone. It's the only connection I have. So, yeah, if he didn't act,
you're right, though, on
valid,
the major
right?
point that he did say we're calling for a ceasefire. I guess I just wasn't, I didn't take it quite as seriously as you seem to, but maybe I should have.
Yeah. Well, that being the bone of contention over the last 3 weeks, in my view, it is big. And as I was starting to say, Poroshenko is going to have to either say yay or, well, he's got no alternative. He'll have to say yay. Whether he follows through on it, of course, is another issue. He tends to lie a lot. And, he can't be expected, even if he promises to initiate a ceasefire, he can't be expected to automatically do that within the next day or so. So these next couple of days are going to be very important. And last night I was thinking through some scenarios that are very much like this. Shoot downs of aircraft like KAL 007 back in 83
Actually, wait a minute. We're about to have to take this break in a couple of minutes, and I'd like to go ahead and let you expand upon, you know, tell that story and talk about the relevance of it, because that is very interesting stuff. But in the short time we have before this break, let me ask you just go ahead and speculate, because that's the least important thing here. It seemed to me like, probably the most likely explanation was that the rebels had done it, probably accidentally, thinking they were hitting a military flight. What's your guess?
If I were forced to guess right now, I would say it was probably the rebels. But, you know, there's no certainty at all, because all three, the Ukrainian armed forces, the Russians, of course, and the rebels all have this same weapon, you know, this Buk, this SS-11. So it's really, really hard to say. But in terms of logic, the Russians control these things pretty damn well. The Ukrainians, not so much. So if indeed the missile is determined to have come from their rebel head territory, then, you know, maybe Samantha Powers is telling the truth.
Well, you know, I guess the silver lining would be if they really can get a ceasefire out of it. I wonder, Ray, whether anybody is thinking about 1914 and how wrong these things can go sometimes, and how maybe it really is time for cooler heads to prevail here. What do you think?
Well, that's my my concern. John Kerry doesn't seem to be aware of the dangers here. He's very blithely dismissed the prospect of war with Russia. That can't, that cannot increase feelings of sobriety in Moscow. So. Yeah.
All right, now hold it right there. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Ray McGovern, former CIA, now peacenik. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show. ScottHorton.org is my website. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. Talking with Ray McGovern. Former at the same time. It came out from. That's terrible. Like David from. Really terrible. No, he is a former CIA guy. Now he is from the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and ConsortiumNews.com, where he writes a lot of things. And so we're sitting here talking about the apparent shoot down of this jumbo jet, a Malaysian airliner over Ukraine yesterday. And yet nobody knows exactly who did it. Let me ask you this, Ray. Had you even heard, first of all, about this Spanish air traffic controller who at least supposedly was at an airport in Ukraine and was saying that he knew that it was Ukrainian fighter jets that shot the thing down, and that the Ukrainian military then came and seized the control tower and tried to intimidate everybody and all this kind of thing. Had you heard about that at all? And then, I guess, do you give it any credibility? It sounds like you're saying it's not disputed that it was a missile. It's not even disputed that it was a surface-to-air missile. Is that correct?
Well, it's mostly correct. There is one other report I've seen this morning, which somebody indicates that he accuses two Ukrainian fighter jets for downing, foreshadowing and then downing the commercial airliner. I don't give much credence to either. The sourcing was suspect.
Yeah. This was just some Twitter feed. I mean, it certainly wasn't verified.
There's going to be a lot of that kind of stuff today and in the next few days. You know, what I'd like to point to here is there were a lot of statements yesterday. But there's one that, in my view, a few people can quibble with, and that is when Putin, the Russian president, got up and claimed that as he put it, quote, the tragedy would not have happened if military action had not been renewed in southeast Ukraine. Now, the reason I mention that is because there are two big supporters of that they could count on. One is named Merkel, the head of Germany. The other one is Hollande, the head of France. And today, Russian diplomat Lavrov accused the U.S. of being one man out on this and said explicitly that it was the U.S. that encouraged Poroshenko not to renew the ceasefire, despite any commitment he may have made to the three other top leaders that he might do so.
Well, that's important. That's very important because...
Oh, wait a minute, Ray. It's Ray McGovern, yeah. Everybody. He's doing a radio interview from a bus right now, which is all right. And it's been working out pretty well most of the time. Had a little bit of difficulty there, but light's still green. Ray, try again, please.
This is just better.
Oh, no, sir. You sound absolutely horrible, actually.
Okay. I don't know what the next Sprint Tower means, but... if you want to expatiate yourself for a minute or two, Scott, that might be good.
Yeah. Okay. I'll see if I can stall for time for just a second. I hate to cut you loose right there in the middle of something. Again, it's Ray McGovern doing an interview from a Greyhound. He's out giving speeches, teaching peace to people. And we're talking about the shootdown, apparently the shootdown of this plane. And he was making a point about the statements versus the stated intentions versus the actual practice of the West pushing for peace there. Ray, you want to try again?
We're on the back of the hill now, Scott. Is this better?
Just barely. Yeah, go ahead. Let's try it.
All right. I was just pointing out that the Russian tactic, at least, is to enlist the French and the Germans into a situation where the isolated people will be the United States. Now that the United States has also called for an immediate ceasefire, the only isolated person is Poroshenko himself. And that's big.
I see, yeah.
If you're still hearing me, I can tell you a little bit about the precedent that I was had a front seat for, let's put it that way, back in 1983 when the Russian air defense fighter shot down KAL, Korean Airlines Flight 007, which they mistook for a U.S. reconnaissance flight or Air Force. The parallel is striking because the White House now has two options. Number one, whatever the truth of the matter, what happened yesterday, there's ample red meat, so to speak, to supply to Fox News and to State Department spokespeople to show how bad the Russians are. Putin, very bad. Putin, shooting down civilian airlines and all that kind of stuff, okay? Even if they lean toward blaming the Putin-supported rebels, okay? Now, that's one way they can go, and that's why I was sort of gratified that it didn't seem that Barack Obama had decided to do that just yet, but give him time, because he'd be under a lot of pressure to do precisely that. What happened with the KAL-007? Well, Secretary Schultz, the Defense Secretary Weinberger, they were really out to give Moscow a bloody nose. So even though the evidence was pretty clear, A, that the Russians didn't know that it was a commercial airliner, the accusation was, quote, the Russians have deliberately shot down a Korean Airlines airliner, okay? Now, that was only half true. It was deliberate. The airliner did not respond to any of the warnings sent by the pilot. And the pilot, the intercepted communications indicated that the pilot never knew. And ground control also didn't know that it was a Boeing 707 resembling the kind of aircraft that NSA and the Air Force drive around those parts of the world. So what I'm saying here is that there's abundant propaganda material if people really want to stir up trouble with Russia. We have to wait and see if Obama will be statesmanlike enough to fend off the neoconservatives and to say, look, you know, this is an unfortunate incident, but let's face it, it's an accident, okay? It was an accident, not deliberate. And that makes a big difference because in 1983, that soured the atmosphere for 2 years until Gorbachev came along mm-hmm. and made it amply clear that he wanted a deal with the United States.
Right. All right, well, I sure appreciate it. I'm sorry we have to stop right there. But I sure hope, I sure agree with you and hope this can be turned into an opportunity for peace since it's already a tragedy rather than everybody making things worse out of it. Thank you so much for your time as always, Ray. You're great.
Okay, welcome.
Ray McGovern, everybody, consortiumnews.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. You know what, man? JDA 2000 is right. I do need to log into Liberty.me today. I haven't gotten around to it yet. Have you guys signed up for Liberty.me? I like it. I admit I haven't spent as much time as I would like to trolling around in there, but that's pretty cool. I was supposed to remember to post today's show. You know, so that my few friends that I do have on there can see it. There, JDA 2000, you and me are bros now on Liberty.me. How do you like that, everybody? You can be just like him at Liberty.me. Oops. There I am. I'm posting the link to LRN.FM there so people can tune in and listen to the show. Like I say, Gareth Porter's coming up to talk about the Iran nuclear talks. So that means I will not. I will hold my fire about that. I do need to talk about Iraq today, don't I? Not right now, though. I want to talk about Israel some more. Hey, listen. So there's this thing. Oh, yeah. There's this thing. I want you to hear this. I hope there's not music at the start of it, is there? Yeah, of course. This is a clip from the 9/11 Commission public hearings where this is in June of 2004, and the 9/11 commissioners are talking with the FBI and the heads of various other federal police, and finally Lee Hamilton asks the question, what was the motivation of the hijackers? Federal police, were you ever able to determine what was going on with that?
I'm interested in the question of motivation of these hijackers. My question is really directed to the agents. What have you found out about why these men did what they did? What motivated them to do it?
At this part, they're all just looking at each other like, man, I don't want to say it, you say it.
I believe they feel a sense of outrage against the United States. They identify with the Palestinian problem. They identify with people who oppose repressive regimes, and I believe they tend to focus their anger on the United States.
So that's James Fitzgerald, FBI special agent, answering the question. Now, I'm trying to remember if he goes on or if this is that annoying video that just repeats it over and over and over again like you didn't just hear it.
They identify.
Yeah, see, then they put in their stupid echo sound effects and all their stupid crap. Great YouTube, idiot. Anyway, So there you have it from the FBI agent, James Fitzgerald. And he's not the boss, right? That's not the prosecutor, Fitzgerald, the famous, you know, politician prosecutor, right? That's just beat cop Fitzgerald. Some FBI agent who, yeah, was on this case. And they ask him, so what's the motivation? He answers, well, they identify with the Palestinian problem and with American support for the dictators in the region. There you go. They identify with people who oppose repressive regimes. And why do they focus their anger on the United States? Because America backs Israel. Because America backs the oppressive regimes. That's why. That's true. That's not just, oh, look, appeal to authority. The FBI, that I think is the least credible organization on the planet, all of a sudden I imbue with super powerful, awesome footnote capability. Whatever they say is true if I agree with it and all that confirmation bias stuff. Except here's the thing of it. No, really, it is true. It's not my confirmation bias. It's the factual bias being confirmed. This is one of those cases where an FBI agent says something that's true. That was already true before he said it. So it's not an appeal to authority. It's just citing an authority who is also correct about this. And where would this guy, again, he's not a political guy. He's just some FBI agent. Where would he get the idea that the Al-Qaeda guys or the September 11th hijackers cared about Palestine? You think he just made that up, or he heard that somewhere or something? Or he's some, you know, alternative media consuming, alternative politics having type person in America of any kind? No, not at all. He's gumshoe FBI agent. You know, blue collar cop, federal cop. Well, light blue. And he knows this because he's been investigating the case. And it's true. If you want to know the best source, well, it depends. There are a few different sources about this. First of all, read Osama bin Laden's declarations of war against America in the first place. They're called against it's the Jews and Crusaders is what he says. And he cites at length American support for the Israelis. And not their very existence and being a nice guy, but for their permanent occupations of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and Southern Lebanon, and the war crimes that they commit against the Palestinians there. And no, I'm not saying Osama would have settled for 67 borders, but that's not what he was complaining about. What he was complaining about was their state of permanent war against the civilians they occupy. Doesn't make it okay what he did, but it's the reason why he did it, so you understand. And if you read Perfect Soldiers by Terry McDermott, LA Times reporter. In fact, he wrote another book that I would like to read that I have not read. But I have read Perfect Soldiers, and it's the biography of the Hamburg cell. And he does get into the San Diego cell, too. But it's the pilots is what he talks about, not the meatheads that were brought in at the end, but the pilots, the ringleaders of the plot in and outside America, in Europe and in America, who orchestrated the 9/11 attacks. Who were these guys? What were they about? Well, Mohammed Atta, especially the leader of them, basically the sergeant of this squad of terrorist soldiers in America, Perfect Soldiers is the name of the book. That is what they were, a team of Osama Special Forces, basically. And Mohammed Atta, their leader, was all about Palestine. And it's documented all over the place. It's not just in Terry McDermott's book, but all over the place. But in McDermott's book, Perfect Soldiers, he talks about how they would go to the mosque and then they would go back to the apartment in Hamburg. They were, again, I'm talking about the 9/11 hijackers. They were they were engineering students in Germany, Egyptian engineering students. And I guess most of them, Atta certainly was. Anyway, and then they would go back to their apartment in Hamburg and watch the news and read the news and were consumed with what was going on in Palestine and always blamed America for all of it. Even if the vast majority of the American people have no idea, the American government is supporting the Israeli indefinite occupation of, I forget how many million people, 5 million people or something. So, you know, it's a real big deal. Think of it like if the Mexican army came in and occupied Mexico. I mean, what the hell am I talking about? San Antonio. I was thinking of San Antonio when I said Mexico. That's strange. There's good Mexican food there. I know where to get some. What if they sack San Antonio and put all the Americans of San Antonio under the rule of the Mexican government? Would you say that the people of San Antonio have no right to resist? Would you say that the people of San Antonio are the perpetrators and the Mexicans are the victims? Anyway, would you understand why people would fight on their behalf? And the September 11th hijackers, that's just one big example, but there are a lot more examples, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew, Ramzi Youssef, who blew up the World Trade Center in 1993, also motivated by Israel and Palestine. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. And yes, I know that the Texicans stole San Antonio from Mexico in the first place and all that. But then again, you know, it was a disputed territory. And old Santa Ana, he didn't really have much of a right, if you ask me. Anyway, it's just an analogy. Anyway, that's the point. But listen, so the reason I'm talking about this is because I think it's important, and I think that, listen, if you already know this, then you already know this. But if you don't know this, then man, this is something that they've been keeping from you, and that would count for most of the American people. That all along, from the dawn of the terror war in the early 1990s, of the terrorist war against us, the Al-Qaeda war against us, Israel has been at the forefront of it. American support for Israel has been at the forefront of the stated motivations and all of the propaganda and recruitment shtick of the terrorists. Always has been. And, in fact, I mean, look at what's going on in the Middle East now, where you have these Sunni jihadists trying to overthrow their dictators here, there, and wherever else. Well, they always were there, especially since, you know, Operation Build them up back there in the 1980s in Afghanistan, and all those guys came home and that kind of thing. But so what was unique about Al-Qaeda? What was unique about Al-Qaeda was Osama took the Azam group, and Zawahiri or Zawahiri, whatever, took Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and they got married together based on the premise that we got to attack America first. We got to drag the Americans into a full-fledged invasion over here under their stated theory that we were already at war with them. And so we just hired all their dictators and protected their dictators and armed all their dictators to keep them all down. And so how are they ever going to be able to overthrow us or overthrow their local people without overthrowing us first, without getting us out of the region first? And so they did the obvious strategy. The same thing that Margulies, and I trust Margulies on this. Margulies says he don't buy it. But at least it makes great mythology anyway, and you can still understand the point. It's still true anyway. That this is why Zbigniew Brzezinski brags that he lured the Soviets into invading Afghanistan, because it was his genius scam to bankrupt them and delegitimize them and drive their evil empire out of existence. It's the obvious thing to do. The Americans had just done it to themselves. You could argue the Russians and the Chinese helped the Americans do it to themselves in Vietnam. And so, and it really sucked for us, too. I mean, you know, 3 million Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians were killed, maybe 5. But anyway, it was still very disruptive to American society in a lot of ways. And so, you know, it was the example of what not to do. So it was, you know, the kind of thing to try to trick the Russians into doing. For our good at their expense. And so Osama decided to replicate the exact same thing with us. In fact, Clinton could have just had him kill when he was in Sudan, but instead had Sudan exile him to Afghanistan. Where, yeah, okay, he's sort of harmless there, except he's got a telephone, and he can meet young grad students from Egypt, you know, studying in Germany, who come to visit. And so he's not completely exiled out there. But on the other hand, he's really hard to get to from here for the military and for the CIA. They kind of exiled him to better safety in Afghanistan. So he said, okay, lure him in. Let's redo this thing. That was the big split between him and the Taliban, of course, was that he was trying to get them in trouble, but they had come to power. They don't want to lose it. They don't want a war with the most powerful military force on earth. But that was the trouble he was getting them in. But anyway, and then so all Bush did, just as bin Laden had predicted, according to his son, Bush and Cheney, these pretend tough guys with the softest hands of any male you ever met in your life, they're going to come over here and they're going to take such advantage. They're going to go hell-bent, balls of the wall. They're going to go crazy. And they're going to blow so much money, they're going to bankrupt the empire. That was the scam. And a major part of all of that was because America supports the Israelis' occupation of the Palestinians. And they, therefore, are helpless and they can't build their caliphate in order to liberate Jerusalem and all of their crap because America's in the way. So that's why they decided they had to focus on attacking us. And as far as, oh, they just believe in Islam so much, that's what made them do it, or, you know, some kind of nonsense like that. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was like a comic book guy with, you know, a white-on-white suit and tie, hot ladies on each arm, little bit of blow probably. He was kind of a pimp daddy sort of guy, sort of character in at least some of his histories. And, you know, it's supposedly a big truth or talking point that the hijackers themselves went to titty bars and whatever. Well, yeah, but all that debunks is that they did it because they love Islam so much. But that's not what it was. They did it because they love the Palestinians so much. They did it because they hated America. And they blamed America, and it was part of their strategy for getting rid of America, finally, to provoke us into finally full-scale invasions of the region to bankrupt ourselves and break our empire. Then we would leave forever. That's the plan. That's what they're trying to do to us, and that's why. And the Republicans, of course, just took them up on it. Obama's continued the exact same policy, and they continue to give the Israelis a blank check to do whatever they want to the people of Palestine. This is why I'm so paranoid about the rise of ISIS, is because not at all that I'm saying putting American military in there would protect us from them at all. That would only make it worse in every way. We've seen what happens. It's not just whack-a-mole. It's more like Mickey Mouse and the Broom in Fantasia, where he makes a zillion more. Every time he tries to kill one, he creates two, or maybe even worse than that. So, I'm not saying that the American government should do anything about it, but I am saying that I'm paranoid that ISIS is a real threat, because America, even though Obama did finally follow up on Bush's promise and pull the majority of the troops out of Iraq, thank God, which is the most important thing of all, but still, America does support the dictators, except in Syria, where we support the revolution, but otherwise we support all the dictators of the region, including the coup government that canceled the Arab Spring in Egypt. Just like always. And we support the Israelis in their endless crimes against the innocents of Palestinian territories, just like always. They withdrew from southern Lebanon, tried to go back to war there in 2006. That didn't work too well, so they've more or less left southern Lebanon alone since then. But they still occupy Palestine, and they continue to do so with American support. Which means that Barack Obama continues to draw a bullseye on the head of American citizens. Not that I'm saying everyone should be afraid in every town in America that a terrorist is going to get you. But then again, you know, if you live near something in a real big city that's a real big prominent target, like two of the tallest buildings named after Nelson and David Rockefeller in the heart of downtown Manhattan, you might look out. If you work at the Pentagon, you know, that's not a threat. Government employees want to take this out of context. I'm just saying this is what happens? This is what the American government is provoking, more enemies against us. And it is true that a lot of these guys have gone to Syria to fight. I don't know how many Americans, many more Europeans than Americans, but Westerners have gone to fight there, do have Western passports. And I know this is a war party talking point, and I'm not trying to say that the war party ought to even exist at all, much less do things. I don't want the U.S. government or, you know, to do a thing. I don't want a think tank to put out a single report about anybody doing a thing. But I'm just saying, you know, I mean, I guess I would like some, in the interim, some kind of great private border cops to check IDs, you know, have the European cops make sure that these guys don't get on planes to the U.S. because they could hit American targets and they could draw America back into Iraq. They could provoke America into doing God knows what. And I'm worried that if they're smart, they might think that that's a good idea. I mean, they could be too clever by half. But there is a strategic logic to suicide terrorism. Provoke a reaction. Provoke a clampdown. Provoke, one, preferably, a reconsideration of your policy. Or two, go ahead and overreact, overdo it. Blow yourself up. Crack down and create, you know, more resistance against you, et cetera, et cetera. That's the tactics of terrorism. That's how it works. The action is in the reaction. And that's the fire that our government is still playing with. And in one of the major ways, through their support for Israel. That's the sad truth. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show. And as often happens on this show, I'm going to interview Gareth Porter now. He's my favorite independent historian and journalist. Writes for IPSnews.net. IPSnews.net. And we republish all of it at antiwar.com, of course. Zarif and Kerry signal momentum on nuclear pact. All right. Welcome back to the show. Gareth, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Scott, glad to be back. Thanks.
Very happy to have you here. And so listen, I was telling the people earlier about how I sure wanted to be optimistic about this Iran nuclear thing, and then you talked me out of it. But now you seem to think that, yeah, hey, maybe so, huh? You saw that same thing by David Sanger in the New York Times that I saw? What a weird conversation we're having already here.
Yeah, I changed my analysis just over the last few days, actually. I was much more pessimistic until I saw the interview that Zarif gave, as well as the remarks by John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, after their meeting. And that turned me around. I believe that it really is quite feasible that they could reach agreement not in the not-too-distant future.
Great. All right. Well, so what was the hang-up and what'd they solve?
Well, I mean, you know, I think your listeners all know that the two big issues that have been the primary points of contention in these negotiations were how many centrifuges Iran could maintain under the agreement, and how long the agreement would last. And of course, those two things are very closely linked for obvious reasons. And you know, the situation as it appeared in recent weeks, and even as recently as the day that John Kerry was to arrive in Vienna for his meetings with Zarif, because there was a briefing given by the usual unnamed senior U.S. official, who was certainly Wendy Sherman. She does all those briefings, so there's hardly any mystery about that. But in that briefing on July 12th, you got at least one glimmer of possible possibly greater flexibility, but basically the line was still that essentially Iran is refusing to move away from what she called unrealistic and unworkable positions. So that I think that's really the main clue that as of that moment, U.S. Expectations, U.S. policy was still that we're a long way from an agreement. But once Zarif and Kerry sat down for those two meetings on Sunday and Monday, the entire tone and content of the U.S. approach to description of the negotiations really dramatically changed. And so that's why, in fact, you know, Kerry's press conference is really the most important document in this recent turn of events. And so, I mean, this is where I think the U.S. news media is showing its utter failure to pay close attention, because you know, they've been hearing and reading for so long the general U.S. Obama administration line that the Iranians are completely unrealistic, they've got to make dramatic changes, and they're refusing to do that, that they paid no attention to the signals in Kerry's press conference, in which he was basically saying, look, things have changed now. And so I think that, you know, the more I read about the press coverage, went back and looked at the press coverage, the more I realized that this is just an absolutely crystal clear example of just how horrible the press coverage of this whole issue is. I mean, you know, the news media are absolutely without the slightest interest in working hard at following what's going on.
Right. Well, I have a different problem of what little media I am. I'm afraid to discuss this great breakthrough because I don't know how to just say the facts without sounding like I'm rubbing Iran's face in it. I mean, these guys are breaking their spine, bending over backwards to appease the United States right now. The U.S. has to make this deal now.
Well, I would describe it a little bit differently, Scott. I think that this is not a situation where only one side is really making the moves. I think that Zarif showed Kerry very carefully what the Iranians had been proposing all along, and you know, I've talked about this on your show. I've described the proposal that Zarif put on the table earlier in the talks. It's been several weeks now. It's been since May that he made the proposal, and it was put into the negotiating draft in June. And what he was proposing was, of course, just to very briefly summarize it, was that Iran would ensure that there would be no buildup of a stockpile of low-enriched uranium that could then be used for a high-level, for weapons-grade enrichment, for potential nuclear weapon, for breakout, as they called it. And they would do that by immediately converting each batch of UF6 or low-enriched uranium, as it came out of the centrifuges, would be then immediately converted into the oxide powder form. And Sanger, by the way, added a new detail to the picture, which I had not gotten previously, and that is that Iran pledged that it would not obtain the facility that would be necessary to actually reverse the oxide powder back into the UF6 form. And I mean, I'm not technically capable of judging the technical merits of that point, but that is something that Sanger did report.
Right.
But basically, the oxide powder then would be sent off to Russia to be turned into the fuel plates for the Bushehr reactor.
So you infer the same thing as me there. It sounded like what he was saying was that you know, they would have to build a new facility, an entire new facility, and they promised not to if they were to ever try to take. I guess they couldn't use the Isfahan, is that how you say it, where they convert right. the yellow cake to uranium hexafluoride gas. They wouldn't be able to do it there. They would need a whole new plant order to deoxidize the uranium.
That is absolutely the implication. Again, I mean, I have not looked into that specifically just to fact check on it, but I presume that, he must be correct, that there has to be a separate facility to do that. In any case, that was a further detail that was added to the mm-hmm. concept that Zarif presented to me as the essence of the Iranian proposal. And he said it was, again, similar to, based on the idea that was proposed by Iran in 2005 in their negotiations with the EU3, which of course, as I reported earlier, was in turn a reflection of some of the suggestions that had been made by the Princeton group, a group of nuclear scientists and some others who were at Princeton University back in 2005. So that was a key element in what I think Zarif said to Kerry. I suspect that Kerry did not have a full grasp of what had actually been put on the table by the Iranians. I think as it passed up through the State Department, through various ranks, he simply didn't get the full effect, the full flavor of what the Iranians were saying they would do. So I think that had a big impact on him. And then I think, you know, he was also told by Zarif, as indicated by Kerry's then press conference, about what actually Khamenei meant to say in his very widely reported speech. Yeah.
All right, now stop right there. That's a great point to pick up on the other side of this break. It's the great Gareth Porter, everybody. IPSnews.net. Manufactured Crisis is the book. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with our friend Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, the true story behind the Iran nuclear scare. And we're talking about the negotiations and very, very good likelihood now of a deal by the end of the month here, it sounds like. And now the last time we spoke, and this goes to where we were interrupted by the break there, Gareth. Last time we spoke, it was about primarily Khamenei's statement that, yeah, you know, eventually we'll have 190,000 centrifuges spinning. Oh, no. And it sounded like, okay, he's staking out a pretty, one, it's a big number for negotiation purposes, but also he's talking about ultimately, and as you write here, Kerry decided to interpret it in the most gentle way possible when we all know John Kerry could have said 190,000. You see what nuclear terrorists these guys are? But instead he goes, oh, no, nah, that's basically just blowing smoke. And he's talking about, you know, one day and this kind of thing. And now I think you were saying when the music was interrupting you there that Zarif had explained what he really meant by that. Can you clarify there?
Yeah, well, I think the inference can be reasonably made on the basis of Kerry's remarks that he got a view of what Khamenei was actually intending to say that either changed his mind completely or confirmed what he might have been told by some of his own experts before he took off. But in any case, what's so really interesting here is that, as again, I think many of your readers are your listeners and readers are familiar with Khamenei's statement of previous Monday was widely reported as though he were staking out a position in the negotiations that was demanding that the United States agree to that level of enrichment for Iran. And in fact, it was never clear that that was the case. And in fact, the wording that Khamenei used in his speech, where he said, "Now we will need this ultimately, we may not need it next year or 2 years from now or 5 years from now," he didn't say how many years it would be. He simply sort of left it unclear. And that, of course, implicitly opened up space for negotiation because, as I said to begin with, you know, really the toughest issue of all is going to be the duration of the agreement. And that is because everybody knows that once the agreement ends, the United States government has made this clear, Iran's going to be free to do whatever it wants. There'll be no requirement for Iran to remain within a particular limit. It will be able to have as much enrichment capability as it wants once the agreement expires. So the fact that he was being imprecise, to say the least, on that point was clearly significant. And, you know, despite that fact, it seems to me very interesting that you had immediately unnamed diplomats or diplomats from unnamed countries, and obviously in this case it was France, if not Israel, who was making these statements, were saying that, Khamenei's remarks have made an agreement now on the level of centrifuges virtually impossible. Now we can write this off. And there was even a leak of an intelligence report, so-called, by another or again, an unnamed state that said the same thing, that essentially Khamenei's using 190,000, he was actually saying separative work units, SWUs, not centrifuges, so you could have had fewer centrifuges but with the same capability for enrichment. And the this so-called intelligence report was saying that, in effect, this makes it virtually impossible to have an agreement. Well, you know, what we now hear from Kerry is that remark, this set of remarks by Khamenei was not intended to place the Iranian demand within the duration of the agreement. This is something outside the agreement. We don't have to worry about it.
Right. And now, is the question of a sort of a stand-in for an additional protocol or some kind of expanded inspections, is that issue being resolved here? Has it already been resolved?
Well, it's interesting, you know, in all of the rhetoric from the Obama administration and even from, you know, the other P5 plus one states, including the French, you don't hear anything about the additional protocol or intrusive inspections. You don't hear, oh, the Iranians are being truculent and refusing to agree to our terms on that. That simply has not been a major point of contention in these negotiations.
Huh. That's interesting. About that.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I have a problem, because, of course, all their nuclear material has been verified to have not been diverted anywhere, and nobody knows where they might get some other uranium from other than what's already safeguarded every last bit. So I guess we would know if that process broke down. So I guess, wow, is it really the case then? The Americans have just, I mean, it always was a propaganda point, so it was that easy to drop, and they really just dropped it, huh? It's amazing.
The propaganda point is what? Which one?
Well, you know, that there's an endless list of questions that must be answered and an endless list of negatives that must be proved and all that.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about the possible military dimensions. I thought you were talking about the additional protocol and sort of
expanded inspection. I mean, there's a handful of UN resolutions based on these U.S. demands, right, which included inspecting the facility where they make the centrifuges,
right,
including
right.
where they make their missiles and all this.
No, there's no question that the Iranians have agreed to the idea that the IAEA will be able to inspect centrifuge shops, the places where they are being manufactured.
Okay, that's an additional thing, because that's not nuclear material being introduced.
That's right. It goes well beyond that, and the Iranians have agreed that can be part of the agreement. Now, you know, missiles is another question entirely. They're not going to agree to intrusive inspections that would allow the IAEA to go wherever they want, where there's a missile base, and say we want to inspect missiles or get information about them. That's a red line that the Iranians have made clear they're not going to.
But you're telling me that Kerry's not even trying it, though.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's really an issue.
That's good. So I guess it's sort of irrelevant, but are they going to end up repealing the UN resolutions that are making all these completely ridiculous demands?
Oh, absolutely. Like that was never a very serious negotiating point. I think that was always a rhetorical device to isolate Iran as much as possible in this process, which is always part of the Obama administration's strategy.
So you don't even think they're going to need an extension? We're going to have this done by the 20th?
No, I'm not saying that. I think that it's probably going to take longer to nail down all the details. But as I quoted Zarif saying, I think the basic, the most important issues that have to be resolved, it could be done with a single decision in Washington to go ahead with this.
All right.
And at that point, then it would be a lot of detailed drafting to be completed. And so I think it's going to go beyond the 20th, but I don't know if it has to go that long beyond.
All right. Great news. Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks very much, Scott.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show. Scott Horton Show. So, man, that sure is good. Like I've always said, like Gareth has always said, it's always been a fake issue anyway. Gordon Prather's been saying that for so long. It never was a real crisis. The Iranians never were making nuclear bombs. And now the issue can finally be put to bed. Although, it occurred to me that maybe this is the worst time for that. For America and Iran to be ganging up against the Sunnis and making that sectarian war worse. I hope relations with Iran don't cool off that much where all of a sudden we're shipping them F-16s. Yeah, not while Netanyahu's around. But actually that's not necessarily true. Right wingers in Israel have said from time to time just think about the Shah's time that, hey, the Persians are a natural ally against the Arabs. Keep them hemmed in. So I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't be Netanyahu. Maybe it'd have to be, their next Nixon to go to China there and follow America's lead on that. And you know what? Just because they get a nuclear deal, that doesn't mean that everything's fine. It still means it's going to take forever for them to lift all the sanctions, or a long time anyway. And it means that they're going to, talk a bunch of hawkish rhetoric all the time on all kinds of things as much as they can. And it's hardly a panacea or whatever the hell. But of all the issues outstanding between America and Iran, that's the one that stands in the way of anything else. You want to complain that they support Hamas and Hezbollah? Okay, fine, but we can negotiate that. What actually gets people worked up, and never mind what, creates the possibility of real war, but what gets people, supporting a government position where our government tries to freeze Iran out of relationships with whatever other countries in the world that we can, and all the rest of this, blackballing them and all that. It's all based on this. It's all based on the scare of a mushroom cloud. After all, if the consequence of whatever risk you're taking is an actual atom bomb going off, then how much risk are you really willing to take? Well, they know that that's how you think. So that's why they always use nuclear bombs as the terrible scare point. Same with Saddam Hussein over and over again, of course. back in 91 and then in 2003. There's no other way to get you to support starting a war. How do you get people to support starting a war? Even in 91, people said, well, you know, Kuwait really was just stolen by the British and, you know, whatever kind of thing. Even then, people kind of knew, hey, you know, Kuwait's not a state in the Union and we actually don't really care about their kingdom and their king's right to rule the people. And what? Saddam Hussein might drop a nuclear bomb on Toledo? Oh, my God. Okay, I'll support Operation Yellow Ribbon then. This will not be another Vietnam. Same thing in 2003. That's where the White House Iraq group settled. They said, we got to put it out there. It's all about the nukes. Mushroom cloud. Cheney, Bush, and Powell, and Rice, all of them, came out with the same talking point about the mushroom cloud. Listen. We can't let the smoking gun. In other words, we don't have any evidence. We're just bluffing. And yeah, you know it, and we know it, and we know that you know it, and you know that we know that you know that we're just lying. But we couldn't let, think of the risk of waiting for evidence if the evidence, if the final proof came in the form of a mushroom cloud over an American city. Wow, we better go to war and make sure that doesn't happen, huh, everybody? Same thing here with Iran. This is what's keeping America from having anything like a normal relationship with Iran. And I'm tired of my government acting like the communists all the time. Isolating people all the time. Isolating Americans from other people all the time. It's crazy. It's evil. It's got to stop. And this is their last big fake excuse to do it. Now from here, every bit of who's selling oil to who and who's sending what, metal pipe to arm Hamas or whatever is the supposedly the scam going on there. All these other issues can be negotiated. And now I've appreciated the Leverett's approach. Flint and Hillary Man Leverett have always said that they just don't think that a nuclear deal can be possible because of all the other bogus issues, too, and that the war party will always ultimately undermine a final nuclear deal by raising all the other issues. And there is a matter of dealing with Congress where, you know, some of these sanctions on the books in Congress say that, you know, they have to become, you know, basically the 51st state and replace their entire constitution and all this stuff before we'll ever lift the sanctions. Now, the president can undo a lot of that himself, but not all of it. Some of it goes pretty far, but... I forgot which tangent I was off on there. How to get back to where I was when I went off on it. But anyway, the point was... I know, it was about the Leverett's. The Leverett's were saying, you gotta just go to Tehran. And just, let's be friends, let's shake hands, or let's, you know, open up relations, shake hands, we'll put an embassy here, and this kind of thing, and all that. And, it's certainly true that there are hawks, and Jim Loeb had this great piece at loblog.com about all the hawks doing everything they can to undermine the nuclear deal by raising every extraneous issue that they possibly can, just as the Leverett's warned. But in this case, it looks like Obama really means to see this thing through. I guess him and Kerry have to be able to take credit for something, their miserable existences. And so... you know, hey, man, if they can undo the fake nuclear controversy between the U.S. and Iran by, you know, this summer, that'd be good, man. That'd be great. And, you know, who knows what'll happen. Again, I hope that doesn't mean that then we go, you know, we become best friends and allies and go to war for Maliki against ISIS or this crap. I don't think it'll move that fast. And I don't think that the Republicans of the war party will be able to undo it. I mean, I don't really know, but we got a pretty strong presidency in America when it comes to foreign policy. And it seems like if the president makes a peace deal and he requires that Congress lift sanctions that they've put down as part of it, that he'll be able to get his way, right? If he really wants it, he can twist some arms. That's the thing with Obama. All the things that he says he's for that are good, he never does anything to make sure it happens. The Senate, all the Senate Democrats and many in the House, and they had some allies among the Republicans way back in the beginning of the administration, they were ready to get the work done to close Guantanamo. But he never helped them at all. He never did a thing to actually help push it forward. He was warned not to, probably by Rahm Emanuel or whatever, I forget now, but for PR reasons, he didn't do it. And, you know, thank goodness when it came to the Syria war, he didn't push Congress either. In fact, the ABC headline was "President calls for conscience vote," which means go ahead and vote no. I don't care. It's fine. Which means, you know, instructions to the leadership to not make too big of a deal about it. Which, that's pretty nice. Especially, that's pretty rare coming from a president, you know, intervening in the Congress in that way, but doing it in such a weak way. That time, I approved. But I think if he wants to lift the sanctions and he wants to strong-arm the Congress on it, he probably can, and for the good. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Key Score, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something important, something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Hey, I'm me. It's the end of the show for the week. Hey, Sunday on Anti-War Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., I'm going to be talking with Dar Jamil about Iraq and Max Blumenthal about Palestine. Next week, I'll have David Stockman on to keep talking, you know, sort of part two of that last interview, all about central banking and war, the boom and the bust, and why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault, the bastard. And, yeah. So that's pretty good. Let me talk about NSA stuff, man. That's been kind of on the back burner here. You know what? I should refresh antiwar.com. Make sure. Still little evidence on what happened to the plane. Ground invasion continues in Gaza. Crowd cheers as missile hits Gaza. Then they threaten a CNN reporter. She has now been pulled from her reporting, just as NBC pulled their reporter from the Gaza Strip too, for daring to tell the truth about what's going on there. Oh, well, yeah, she calls them scum. And of course, the joke is she only calls them scum after they threatened her and threatened to destroy her car if she reported on them laughing their asses off watching the IDF slaughter civilians wantonly in the Gaza Strip below.
And you can see another rocket going in from Israel, slowly making its way, presumably a precision-guided missile, coming into the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and it seems as though the bombardment has been very much in Beit Lahia. Now, the sound that you are hearing here, we're on the top of a hill, and I think you can probably see there are lots of Israelis gathered around who are cheering when they see these kinds of Israeli strikes. And it is an astonishing, macabre, and an awful thing, really, to watch this display of fire in the air. But really, it is what is going on in the ground, Wolf, that is significant.
Yeah, boy, I think she kind of changed what she was going to say right there for a second. What was macabre going on in the sky? No, she was talking about these people cheering it on, but then you could see there's somebody kind of off camera, but you see his arm, his shoulder. He's getting a little bit close to her. She sort of looks at him like, you know, I think I better not get punched in the jaw right now. That's on CNN. They yanked her because she tweeted out, Israelis on hill above Sederot cheer as bombs land on Gaza. Threaten to, quote, destroy our car if I say a word wrong, scum. And, of course, really, it sounds to me like they're only scum to her because they threatened her. But, of course, they're scum if they're cheering the slaughter of little children, which is what they're cheering. A massive canned hunt. Like Dick Cheney and their tough and his tough guy friends. They are scum. Anyway, she said that. I think I actually read that she was exiled to Russia. They put her in Moscow, which is, get it? You know, exiled to Siberia kind of thing. Ha ha. America as the evil empire. Got her own domino theory and everything. And then the NBC reporter, he was not pulled because he tweeted some crass statement. He was pulled because he did grade A, first-hand, top-notch journalism about what happened in that beach massacre. And so he got yanked. He did one good report. And then one appearance on the Chris Hayes show, but then was pulled out of the Gaza Strip by NBC. And he's their star reporter, and as Glenn Greenwald reported at The Intercept, that's how he got the job working for NBC in the first place, was because he did such great journalism about the Israeli attack on Gaza back in 2012. And they said, man, we gotta get this guy. And he's there, he witnesses firsthand what happened to these little boys. He reports about it. They pull him out of the Gaza Strip. I talked about this the other day, but still. Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept. They replaced him with, what's his name, the hack, to tell it from Israel's point of view. By the way, if you hadn't read this, it's on the blog at antiwar.com. Dan Sanchez has a great write-up about it, about how they completely rewrote the article at the New York Times in order to put the blame on the four little boys. They should have known not to be on the beach. Really. And in fact, if you go to antiwar.com/blog and read Dan Sanchez, or if you go to antiwar.com/Justin, they both link to this newsdiff.org or .com or something, this magical, beautiful, wonderful website. There's a gift from the gods or some genius nerd or some wonderful person. And what they do is they keep track of all the changes made to published news articles. When Winston Smith goes back in there, you know, with a gun to his head and rewrites the past for us, they keep track. And so little brother at least has access to what big brother is doing. And anyway, if you go back and look, I promise you, your jaw will drop. You could show this to your friends and they will be like, nuh-uh. When you show them just the extent, the lengths that the New York Times went to in order to rewrite their news article about the shelling of the little boys on the Gaza beach the other day. It's incredible. You got to see it. Antiwar.com/Justin or /blog. Either way, you find Dan Sanchez there on the blog. Man, it's really incredible. And then to see this, where the NBC reporter is pulled, the CNN reporter is pulled. And was she even pulled because she said scum on Twitter? Or that was just the perfect excuse? Thank God. She reported on the what was she doing up on Sederot Hill reporting on the laughing, cheering Israelis watching the slaughter below? You know, on the hill that they stole. Because they're thieves and murderers. Nice stolen hillside. Guys, let's get a couch and some popcorn, smoke a joint, and kick back and watch little Gazan children be dismembered by American-bought high explosives. It'll be a barrel of fun. Yeehaw, they cry. Amazing. And now, I'm sorry, I was going to talk about the NSA. I'm almost out of time. Greenwald wrote a thing. It's called Hacking Online Polls and Other Ways British Spies Seek to Control the Internet. And I mentioned this the other day, but I hadn't read it yet. I still haven't read it. Is that the whole thing? Huh. Well, I should have read it. It's really short. You should read it too. It's really short, apparently. If only I had looked at it before, I would have crammed this into my brain a commercial break real quick or something. Hacking Online Polls... In other ways, British spies seek to control the internet by Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept. Is GCHQ awesome and 100% legal? You have two choices in the poll. Yes and yes. Thank you very much. Good. But yeah, anyway. Oh, one more thing about the NSA. Over the weekend at antiwar.com, we're going to be running this thing by Barton Gellman. I'm pretty sure we're not running it yet. Let me check here. Oh, maybe are we already running it? What the hell have I been doing? What did I do with that damn thing? Maybe we're running it as news. Oh, hell. Go find it at the Washington Post. It's Barton Gellman, who is the Washington Post version of Glenn Greenwald on the NSA story. Snowden gave him all the stuff, too. And he wrote up that gigantic thing about how they went through a ton of data, and in their sample, it was 90% of the people caught up in the NSA surveillance. All the stuff are people who are not targets at all. And then about half of them are Americans. Half of the same group are Americans, rounded up in the government, the federal governments, the NSAs, the militaries. The NSA is part of the military. They're unlimited data mining, illegal, unconstitutional surveillance program of Americans. And he wrote a follow-up explaining and elaborating all about it. It's really worth your read. And I think it's not on antiwar.com, but it'll be running as a view tomorrow, maybe. Otherwise, see you Sunday morning or back here Monday at noon. Thanks for listening.